So let me remind you where we were. So G was, okay, so I asserted that given some Lie algebraic information, there is a construction of a linear functional on A, which amounts to saying, I mean, right, you can restrict it to any fixed degree, and then at that fixed degree, you will get a finite type invariant. So we get lots and lots of finite type invariants, one for each metrized Lie algebra and finite dimensional representation and a choice of a degree. Okay? So let G be a metrized finite dimensional Lie algebra, R a finite dimensional representation, and I asserted that I can make this construction, and of course it's not quite a theorem because, I mean, to be a theorem I have to assert something definite. So it's more a construction. Okay? Here's the construction. So first of all, you take the Lie algebra and you code it by a number of arrays of numbers, okay? The so-called structure constants. So you choose a basis for the Lie algebra, xA, A goes from 1 to the dimension. You choose a dimension, a basis for the representation, E alpha. Alpha goes from 1 to the dimension of the representation. And then everything becomes numbers. So the bracket, all you need to know in order to know the bracket is the bracket of two basis elements. So you call xA, xB, well, it's a linear combination of the xC's, and you call the coefficients fA, bC. And these are the so-called structure constants of the Lie algebra, and if you know them, you know everything about the Lie algebra itself. Second, the metric is encoded by a two-index tensor, so all you need to know is the inner product of xA with xB, and you call it TAB, and I've assumed that the metric is symmetric and invariant and non-degenerate. Non-degenerate means that this matrix is invertible, so I call the inverse T upper BC, and this just amounts to saying that TAB, TBC is delta AC. Okay? And finally, there are the matrix elements of the representations. So each XA is a matrix, so we should get a matrix for each A. Or a different way of saying it is that if you let XA act on E alpha, you get a combination of E betas, and you call the coefficients rho A alpha beta. So for every A, you have a two-index matrix. Okay? And that completely codes the information of the information inside the representation. So now, given this information, I am going to construct WGR. Oops, before that, one further bit of information. So a different way of coding the structure constants is taking the bracket and expanding it in terms of the basis, given that the metric is non-degenerate, it's enough to know what the inner product of this with every basis element is. So take the inner product of this with xc and call the result fabc. And that's sort of an equivalent coding of the bracket, okay, of the structure constants. How is it equivalent? So one way to do it is the following. So xA bracket xB is a linear combination of xD's with coefficients fA, b, d. And then for each xd, I need to take its bracket with xc, but that just gives me tdc from here. So that's tdc, and of course I have to sum over d, but of course I don't write the summation, because one index is above, one index is below, Einstein holds. Okay. So, well, not yet proof of theorem, but the construction leading to the theorem. So construction of or in proof of theorem. So let me do the construction by an example, okay? And it's clear that the example will be completely general. So given a diagram D, I need to construct a number, okay? So what should we take? What's the Japanese symbol for dai, da, or there is, is it, I forget if it's this way, the Chinese maybe, if it's this way or upside down. I don't know. Anyway, let's choose this one, okay? So, but it will be clear that it's completely general. So what I do is I mark every half chord or half internal edge with an English letter, sorry, with a Latin lowercase letter. Okay? And of course, you know, you're welcome to change conventions, okay? But I mean, so let's mark this one with A, this one with B, this one with C, but then I said every half edge. So the other half edge for this will be A prime, B prime, C prime, and I still have this edge, so I'll mark it D, D prime. Okay? And then mark every skeleton edge with a Greek letter. So alpha, beta, gamma, delta and epsilon. Da. I don't know. Now, do the following. So, for every internal trivalent vertex, write the structure constants at the indices appearing around this vertex. So we have only one internal trivalent vertex, so we write FABC, Z structure constants, the one in which they're all below. Okay? So maybe I'll just write a set of rules. So for every internal trivalent vertex, if it is surrounded by three English letters, sorry, Latin letters, you send it to FABC, lower indices, okay? And note that internal trivalent vertices are oriented, and the convention is that if nothing else is specified, they are oriented counterclockwise. So take the structure constants using the orientation, okay? So so go counterclockwise. Next, for every internal edge, well, every internal edge has two Latin letters around it. So for every internal edge, take the inverse structure the inverse metric. So TAB will go, sorry, so an edge going from A to B will go to TAB. So FABC, and then I have four edges, AA prime, BB prime, CC prime, and DD prime. So I get here TAA prime, TBB prime, TC prime, C, TDD prime. Next, for every skeleton vertex, well, near every skeleton vertex, you have three indices, one Latin and two Greek. Okay? So map it to rho at the Latin, well, the corresponding rho. So in our case, it will be rho. But I think, sorry, I need to make it the same. I want it this way. So rho sub A and the incoming index will go above and the outgoing index will go below. Okay? So in our diagram, there are five of these. So let's see, what do we get? We get rho, let's start from here, A prime delta epsilon, A prime delta epsilon, rho D prime epsilon delta, D prime epsilon, sorry, epsilon delta, rho B prime gamma alpha, B prime gamma alpha, rho C prime alpha beta, C prime alpha beta, and I hope this is the last because I'm running out of space, rho D beta delta, rho D beta delta. Okay? And now, well, you know, if you're a mathematician, add the summation. If you're not a mathematician, don't even bother with adding the summation. Okay? So which summation is it? It's a summation over all Latin letters, so A up to D prime, running from 1 to the dimension of the Lie algebra, and all Greek letters, so alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, running from 1 to the dimension of the representation. Okay? And then and then the real claim. Okay? So claim, so far I gave you a procedure that assigns to a diagram a number. Okay? But it's a diagram plus further choices. So claim. And I should give a name to this number. So if this diagram is D, then I will call this WGR of D. So claim 1, WGR of D is well defined, and this amounts to two things. So it does not depend on choices made on this blackboard. I'll specify what these are in a minute. And two, does not depend on choices made on previous blackboard, meaning this blackboard, and I'll explain what these are also in a minute. And part two of the theorem is W. So it's not only well defined on diagrams; it actually descends to the quotient. So it's well defined on A. So, in other words, W, G, and R satisfies the three relations defining A. In fact, only one relation defines A, STU. But I still want to pretend that the other two, well, the other two are not necessary, but they're lovely, so I'll state them anyway. So, WGR satisfies anti-symmetry, IHX, and STU. I guess STU implies the other two, but I'll check them independently. Okay? Is it clear? So, by the way, how arbitrary is it? You may think it's arbitrary, but in fact it isn't. So, basically, if you are given this amount of information, a Lie algebra and a representation, the structure constants automatically are there. And now you ask yourself, suppose I wanted to generate a scalar, a single number out of the structure constants, what could I do? Okay? So basically this is the only thing you could have done which involves only contractions of upper and lower indices. Okay? Which is significant, which in a minute will mean that this is well defined. Okay? So basically, anywhere, if you wanted to get a number out of this much information, how could you do that? Well, you'd have to write FABC somewhere, and then you'd have to contract this A with something. The only thing this A can be is the only place I have an upper index, an upper location for an A is in a TBC. Well, maybe also here, but these are equivalent to those, so there's no, I don't gain anything by using these. Okay? So I would have to put a TAA prime somewhere. And then this AA prime has to contract with something lower. So it has to contract either with an FA prime DE, or, well, I mean, let's pretend it contracted with that and do this, play the same game with B. So the B will have to connect to some TBB prime. And then this B prime will have to contract to either an F, as before, or to a rho. So I will have to write here rho B prime alpha beta. Right? And then at some point, things might start closing against themselves. So for example, I could have T, instead of just finding an upper index to match with this C, and calling it TCC prime, C prime could have been equal to D. I could have found upper indices matching two indices at the same time. So it could have been TCD here. If you keep writing a thing like that, eventually you're defining a trivalent graph. Okay? So every thing like that will correspond to a vertex. Every T upper AB will correspond to an edge. So you get vertices and edges. There are two types of vertices, so-called internal vertices and external and skeleton vertices. Okay? And the information and sort of choosing which index contracts with what is exactly which deciding which edge connects to which vertex. So if you write an expression like that, it will define a trivalent graph. Okay? So this is not at all arbitrary. This is exactly the collection of all scalars you could produce out of a Lie algebra. Okay? Anyway, now back to the proof of the claim. So, what order should I do that? The problem is that I'm now committed to keeping both blackboards because both of them appear in the statement of the claim. I have to do it short. I don't know. Okay, so what are the choices that were made in this blackboard? So, first of all, the choice of the names of the letters. That's obviously irrelevant. These are dummy variables. More interestingly, whenever I had an internal edge, I chose to write TDD prime, but I could have chosen TD prime D. The edges are not oriented. In order to, so, and in fact, I've kind of demonstrated it here by one of the T's writing it in the opposite order, okay? So why doesn't it depend on that? Well, that's the fact that T is symmetric. So I don't know, maybe I should change this to A and B. So A, the facts that go in are the fact that TAB is symmetric, and and likewise, around each vertex, I chose the indices to go cyclically, but I still had to choose a starting point. So the second fact is the fact that F is symmetric. So, or cyclically symmetric. So F is cyclically symmetric, meaning FABC is equal to FBCA is equal to FCAB. This is an exercise, as always. Okay? I mean, really, I only feel committed to reduce everything to easy things, but basically it follows from the fact that the metric is invariant. Okay? So it actually follows from you need two facts in order to do it. First of all, or maybe the easy way to do it, involves two facts. So, first of all, FABC is equal to negative FBAC. This is the fact that the bracket is anti-symmetric. Okay? And second, FABC is equal to negative FACB. So permuting the first two switches a sign, and permuting the last two switches a sign. And the second fact is the fact that the metric is invariant. If you write down what it means for the metric to be invariant in terms of the structure constants, I believe that's what you get. Anyway, these two things taken together mean that F is totally anti-symmetric. F is totally anti-symmetric, meaning if you sort of the representation of S3 that you get by permuting the indices is the sign representation, but in particular it means that it's symmetric under cyclic permutations because these have parity 2. Okay? Good. So A is done. Now the harder thing. What choices appeared in the previous blackboard? So the choices that appeared in the previous blackboard, maybe I will here are the choices that appeared in the previous blackboard. The only choices were the choice of a basis for the representation and a basis for the Lie algebra. So this is now a real claim, okay? So let me tell you why the end result does not depend on these choices in three different ways. So way number one, I guess I'm doing now proof of 1b. In fact, three proofs of 1b. So one, as a physicist, so physicists will tell you that this is exactly the reason why they make a distinction between upper indices and lower indices. Okay? So the whole point of applying the Einstein summation convention only when you have upper indices and lower indices, when you sum upper indices and lower indices, is because this corresponds to, one corresponds to a space, the other corresponds to its dual space, to coordinates in a space, the other corresponds to coordinates in its dual space. If you do a change of variables or a change of basis in a space, the corresponding change of basis for the dual space using the dual basis is implemented by the inverse matrix, and the fact that you allow yourself to contract only upper with lower means that you never contract means that the results that you get are basis independent. Okay? So this is a bit informal, physicists would immediately recognize it. So as a physicist, and I'll only say that with only contracted upper with lower indices, and that's basis independent. No, they wouldn't use basis independence. They would say generally covariant. I don't know what the.
Maybe,
I'm not sure.
Maybe they can say this is a scalar.
What?
This is a scalar.
And not a scalar. Right, they would say a scalar. The meaning of the word scalar is basis independent. Yes. Okay. Anyway, two, so as a mathematician or as a sophisticated mathematician, I would say exactly the same thing, but in math language. Namely, I would say that F lower three indices is really an element. What is it? It's an assignment that takes three elements of the Lie algebra and produces a number. So it's really an element in the Lie algebra dual tensor, the Lie algebra dual tensor. Tensor the Lie algebra dual. Likewise, T with upper two indices. Well, what is T with upper two indices? It's the inverse of T with lower. So maybe I'll start with T with lower two indices. Takes two elements in the Lie algebra. So it's an element in G dual tensor G dual. And then T lower A, sorry, T upper A, B is the inverse of the previous, so it's an element in G tensor G. And finally, rho takes one element of the Lie algebra, so it is an element of G dual, but it spits out an endomorphism of the vector space, meaning a matrix, right? An element, an endomorphism of the vector space is an element of R dual tensor R. So a mathematician would say F is here, T is here, T up is here, and rho is here. And what have we done here? What have we really done here? So really, given a diagram, let me take a simpler one. Given a diagram, really what we've done is, first of all, we've decomposed it into pieces. So now it looks like a tick, tick. No, oh my god. It's more pieces than I thought. You know what, let's take a simpler diagram. Okay, so it decomposes into pieces, okay? Basically, I cut each edge in the middle. Sorry, not in the middle. I've cut each edge twice. I've cut around each vertex. I made three cuts around each vertex. And that's what I wanted to do before, but it came out too many pieces. And then this piece corresponds to a T dot dot. This piece corresponds to a row, this piece corresponds to a row. This piece really lives in G dual tensor R dual tensor R. This piece lives in R dual tensor G dual tensor R. Okay? And this piece lives in G tensor G. So now the three tensor these three pieces together, and I get an element. So I get an element in, so this thing becomes an element in, oh my god, many, 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 many copies. So G dual tensor R dual tensor R. Tensor, this is for the left. Tensor G, tensor. R tensor G dual tensor R dual. R tensor G dual tensor R dual. Maybe. Okay? And then the graph is really a bunch of directions of which vector space to tensor with its dual, sorry, to contract with its dual, or which evaluation map to apply of a dual on a space. So you are asked to evaluate this dual element against that element. So in other words, you contract this with this. Then you contract this with this, and you contract this with this, and finally you contract this with that, and you've contracted everything and you've gotten a number. So far I've repeated the construction. The claim that it's well defined, just a second, is just the claim that the operation evaluation of a dual on a vector is basis independent. Yes?
I should contract them together.
Oops, you're right. I've contracted this R twice. That's a bit impossible. Okay. Thank you. And that was the second proof. And here I'll put the third proof. So the third proof is sort of low level math, or just hands-on math, if you wish. Just write everything in coordinates. So change basis and see what happens. So go from x alpha, from xa to yb. You'll get a new tensor. So every yb can be written as m a b x a. I mean, this m, or rather m inverse, will appear in what I wanted to say. Now use this m to rewrite f a b c. So FABC will get replaced by, so corresponding to the basis X, will get replaced by FYABC, which can be written in terms of M and the old F. Okay? So basically, implement everything. And then when you do the corresponding construction to here using the Y basis, and also using some alternative basis for the representation, you will find that, you'll have fy, ty, and rho y everywhere. And then, when you will change variables from fy to fx, you will get lots and lots and lots of change of basis matrices, and they will all come in pairs that are inverses of each other. So they cancel. But I don't want to, I will not do it. I mean, if you want, you can do it. But that's completely hands-on. Okay, how are we doing? Okay, so there's one last thing to do to prove statement number two. Eva, can I erase this? Can I erase this? Okay, so proof of two, well, again, I think my goal is not to actually prove things, but just to give enough hints so that you will be able to prove them yourself. So, let's prove IHX, then anti-symmetry, then STU. So, IHX becomes the following. So, first of all, where does I go? So, inside a big diagram, you're going to end up labeling everything. So let's let the labels be A, B, C, D, and E. Okay? So IHX will map it to, this is I. But WGR, well, R is irrelevant here because we're inside the diagram, but WG will map this to ECD, FABE,
and T, so I suppose this has to be labeled twice, E and E prime. So A, B, E prime, and then T, sorry, F, A, B, E prime, T, E, E prime. Okay? And you can check that this is F, A, B, sorry, F, A, B, E, F, E, C, D, T, E, C, D, T, or maybe let me call this one E prime, T, E prime, D. Okay, so basically replace each of these by its definition using, well, I've erased it already, using the metric, and you'll get to this. So this amounts to saying that, okay, and on the other hand, this is, well, you take the bracket of XA and XB, you, well, the result you call XE, and then you take its bracket with XC. So you take the result and take its bracket with XC, and then you take the inner, sorry, the bracket with XC, and then you take the inner product of that, this is this, with XD. Okay? So, anyway, nothing to say, okay? Likewise, H, by a similar process, will go to, well, XD will remain in place, but over here you'll get a cyclic permutation of the three indices, X, A, B, C. Okay? And X will go to the remaining cyclic permutation, the other cyclic permutation. And overall, sorry, with signs. Again, I don't want to commit to the signs. Okay? And overall, you will get that IHX will go to the Jacobi identity, which holds in Lie algebra. And therefore, IHX is satisfied. So, or here's a different way to say, there are two brackets here. The Jacobi identity is about contracting two brackets together in three different ways. So, two brackets here, I mean, these are the three different ways, and the two vertices correspond to the two brackets. Okay, so that's the IHX, and likewise for the anti-symmetry and STU. So what does anti-symmetry go to? It's actually, sorry, the wrong direction. So Jacobi identity implies IHX. So what is anti-symmetry implied by? So anti-symmetry is reversing the orientation around the vertex, but that's just taking the bracket in the order. The vertex just represents the bracket, so that's just taking the bracket in a different order. So this is implied by anti-symmetry in Lie algebras, meaning xy is negative yx. And finally, what implies STU? So what is STU? STU is this is equal to this minus that. So let's kind of verbalize it. Representing a bracket, this is taking the bracket, and this is the representation tensor. So representing a bracket is the same as multiplying the representation matrix in one order or in another order. Okay? So this gets implied by the fact that when you represent a bracket, it's the same as representing A, representing B, minus representing B, representing A, and this is the definition of a representation. That's what a representation means. Okay? So, at some level, and it's a bit informal, WGR, so really W sub two indices, is somehow a pairing, is a pairing which takes Lie, or which takes a pair, Lie algebra and representation, but also a diagram, and gives a number, scalar. So the pairing is sort of nearly complete, is nearly anything it could possibly be. So I took all the possible diagrams I could have taken, right? That's what I asserted before. And furthermore, I've used everything that I've known about Lie algebras and representations. Right? The structure constants code everything there is to know about G and R. And there are relations in the definition of G and R, and the relations are essentially the Jacobi identity and the fact that the representation represents. And I've used what is almost literally those. So in some sense, it's I've used everything I had. Okay? So in some sense, the relation between Lie algebras and finite type invariants is extremely deep. Right? I mean, I got to the space of diagrams without making any choices whatsoever, starting from not theory and not making any choices. And what I got has sort of complete pairing in some sense, or in some informal sense, with Lie algebras. Anyway.
George, sorry, just on the first line, I missed, how did you get the second expression?
From here to here?
Yeah.
I've used the definition of ABE.
Okay.
Okay? So an ECD, I mean, this was defined to be FEC D prime T D prime D.
I see.
Okay? So when you use all of these definitions, you come to this. And you use the fact that, so basically, informally, you get twice T lower indices here, once from here, but you have one T upper indices, and they're inverses, so it will cancel one of the two and you will be left with one. Okay? Anyway, this leads to this kind of informal reasoning leads to a concrete conjecture. So conjecture, this pairing really is non-degenerate. Okay, meaning it in fact has two meanings. So one. One is completely formal and the other is a bit less formal. So one, every weight system comes from this construction. So let's say differently, if you go over all Lie algebras and you look at all WG sub R's, so if you look over at all of these, so you look at all WG sub R where you let G and R be arbitrary. Well, then, and you look at the span of this, that spans everything. So every weight system comes from this. So this should be a dual. So that's conjecture number one. And conjecture number two. So it would mean something like every scalar coming from Lie algebras really does come from this, every scalar corresponding to Lie algebras comes from this construction. So this is too informal. I don't know what it means to be a scalar coming from Lie algebra. Okay? But let me tell you that there is a formalization for this, and the formalization will be that every invariant tensor, and this is an undefined notion, I will have to define it, okay? Every invariant tensor comes from a diagram. Okay? And the lovely thing about this conjecture is that both statements are false. Okay? So it appears like it's a complete, total, perfect pairing, but it isn't. Okay? So this is false by work of Vogel, and it's surprisingly hard. So it's like if you go to a relatively high degree, I think up to degree 18 or so, which is more than has been computed, it's true. And then there is a counterexample. So at degree 18 or so, there is a weight system that does not come from Lie algebra. And the construction is very, very sneaky somehow. And it sort of constructs one exception. Or maybe not one, but sort of a tiny, tiny, tiny family of exceptions. So somehow the conjecture is almost true, but not true. Okay? At least to the extent that we know it now. Okay? What I mean is that likely once something starts breaking, it usually breaks big. So the expectation is that in high degrees, it will be totally false. But we still don't know how to break it in a big way. We only know how to break it in a very, very sneaky way following Vogel. And the second bit of this conjecture is totally fails. I don't think I will I will want to make it precise. It's too far to decide, it's only for culture, but basically already for SU3, it's easy to write a three-index tensor which is invariant and does not come from a diagram. Okay? So, anyway, end of story. If I had a few more minutes, and I will have a few more minutes, but it will be next Monday, I would go through an example. So far it looks completely abstract, but what I want to do next is to do this construction for the case of GLN. And for the case of GLN, you will find that everything is actually easily explicitly computable in very algorithmic, simple-minded ways. Okay, so see you Wednesday.